Yes, this is another edition of We the People, and that's our theme song in the background that you heard, Harry Nilsson's Sweet Haven from the Popeye movie. Today we have in the studio Rob Perry, the superintendent of Public Works in Hudson, New York. And we're going to find out a little bit what his job is in the city and ask him questions about current issues involving the infrastructure of Hudson, of which you are in charge, right, Rob?
That's
pretty
correct.
Much. I mean, as I understand it, by the way, in our archive, there's an interview with Rob from about 2 years ago where you can sort of get the fundamental facts of what he does here in Hudson and its background. I understand your background was in business and a project manager. Now, you were on the Common Council. You were the president of the Common Council?
I was elected to the Common Council as president, yes.
And how many terms were you?
I did half of one term.
Oh,
I was
what
one
happened?
Year. I took this job.
Oh. You mentioned that at the time, Mayor Scalera sort of asked you to step in with this job, for this job.
Correct. It was a roundabout discussion about other positions I was interviewing for in the private sector, and it was a matter of managing the workload as chairman of the Planning Commission, as council president, as well as, you know, new duties and responsibilities. And at that point, he suggested that I consider this position, mm-hmm. and we had a series of discussions back and forth, and the rest is history.
Now, in previous times, the superintendent was a engineer. Apparently, this was changed before or after you were being considered.
This was changed before I was considered. It had been, well, to be fair, the last engineer was there for 37 years. It was Charlie Butterworth, so
oh, sure.
Not a whole lot changed
right.
during that time as far as the requirements. And my very loose recollection is that they had someone who would come in and he worked a year before resigning. He was an engineer, and then to expand the base, they went to the Civil Service Commission and the council, and I'm not sure exactly what took place. It was before I was on the council,
mm-hmm.
and modifications were made to the job description to allow for people to supplement private or public sector experience in construction and project management, if you will, and have college education and some mix and match to qualify and meet the requirements.
Right. Do you feel, I assume that when there is an engineering issue, you consult actual engineers, or is that, do you
absolutely.
Find
it? And yeah. honestly, that's the way it was done before.
Right.
I mean, although Mr. Butterworth was a PE, he wasn't designing the water plant.
Right.
He wasn't designing water mains. Everything was being consulted and contracted out even then.
Right. Like, for example, in the latest superintendent report, you talk about, you know, you've had all these problems with both the with all the storms, and lately it's been the rainstorms as opposed to what we had the winter. We'll get to that also, which
sure.
was, I'm sure, a disaster for you. And I noticed that, you know, you talk about how the sewer repair. So I wondered, when you need to repair one of the sewers, and we'll get to the larger topic. I mean, I know you have 30 miles of pipes to worry about. Now, how do you decide how to design those repairs? I mean, or call it design, whatever you want to.
Yeah, actually, the repairs are very low-tech and old-school. You know, when you're going into a stone sewer, there's really only one way to do it, and that's to excavate the material around it, clean it up, find out where you can make a connection between something that's good, and you basically bridge it with rebar, which is steel bar, mm-hmm. Bricks, patch up the holes with some clay, make a form, which is installed a wood background and or a wood form, and then pour concrete to repair it. When we do clay tile breaks, it's different. If it's a plastic pipe, you know, you're just going to remove the section that's excavate again, remove the section, and maybe insert a piece of plastic with some fern coats, which you've seen fern coats in mm-hmm. your it's exactly the same thing. Instead of being 2 inches to go underneath your kitchen sink that's leaking, these are 18, 20 inches, even larger if you need to.
What percentage of the sewage system is plastic at this point, and what is the old material?
There's very little plastic, if at all. Most of it is stone or brick. You know, then you'll have some clay tile that was done probably, you know, you'll see that on the boulevards, because that was when it was being, that was the material of the day back in the 30s, 40s, mm-hmm. and such. There are some sections of that were put in the 60s that are ACP, which is asbestos concrete pipe. You know, so you do have different materials in there, but the largest segment of our system is stone and brick.
And most of that is original or?
Which
dates to like when?
The very beginning.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't have an exact date on it, but they're old. There was some newer stuff put in during urban renewal in the 70s. So portions of Columbia Street, Warren Street were upgraded at that point. I think even some sections of Allen. But by and large, it's...
Now, is this... I was going to call it a phenomenon, but is this sinkhole disaster a result of... is it related to this sewer problem?
Absolutely. What happens is, you know, under normal flows, there's... imagine like a stream, you know, a babbling brook going through, and that's what it is. When you have the rainwater mixes, you get this violent torrent of water.
And that especially happened during that incredible storm where many of us had flooded basements.
Correct. And that force of that water, if there's any kind of a weak spot, I mean, I don't, without being technical, there are literally rat holes. I mean, rats live in the sewers and they make holes going in and out. Well, those create weaknesses and fissures where the water gets in and it actually will rip the stones out of place. And then that begins to liquefy the surrounding material until there's nothing left. And we have, you know, anywhere from 6 to 10 inches of concrete underneath most of the roads in Hudson. So it's not uncommon to see an 18-inch hole on the top of the road. And then when we open it up, to find a massive chasm that's, you know, 12 feet deep, 8-10 feet wide, and 20, 30 feet long. I mean, once we get into it, once we open it, we really don't know what to expect.
So when one drives down, say, Columbia Street, where there's been considerable damage, I guess the first question people have is why isn't the entire street shut down? I mean, do you have to assess each hole and determine, can it spread? Can it sustain the rest of the street nearby?
Well, doing a road shutdown is a last resort.
Right.
I mean, we want to keep traffic moving for all vehicles, because anytime there's road shutdowns, we have to notify the fire control, so it becomes, you know, a safety issue. I mean, there's restricted access for emergency vehicles, not just ordinary traffic. You know, we coordinate with the police department to a certain extent. We coordinate. Certainly, it inconveniences neighbors and residents. So,
does DOT have to be alerted because it's a truck route?
If we're going to be closing the truck route down, we absolutely have to notify DOT. And
Department of Transportation.
Yes.
I just wanted to throw in a little acronym.
Sure. There's plenty to go around. And we do let them know, and they'll assist us by putting some variable message boards, which are those light
big signs.
They'll put some out on the truck routes outside of the city. We obviously don't have any jurisdiction to do anything outside of our city limits. But, you know, those are reserved for the largest
failures. I guess what I'm getting at is there a sense that the kind of tonnage that big trucks present makes a special problem where there's nearby sinkholes?
Well, certainly, you know, trucks are heavier than vehicles, and I believe there's a multiplicative or an exponential effect with a fully loaded truck, you know, equating to thousands of car trips or something like that. That's not for me to decide. I'm not in the where trucks go and where they don't go business.
I understand that.
I'm in the keep the roads open business.
But, you know, the last thing you want is a truck falling into one of your sinkholes.
Absolutely. But let's, you know, and that would be a symptom. But, you know, I started out my career in healthcare, and we always talked about treating the disease, not the symptom. And, you know, if we upgrade these sanitary sewers and separate them as we're required to by law, then you can drive an M1, A1 tank down the road, and it's not going to have an issue.
So let's get to that. That's in the works, right? That separation, or is there?
Yeah, it's going to be. I mean, it's a long-term project. I mean, it would be tens of millions of dollars to do it as one project, and we simply, it's unrealistic. So, you know, this is something that has been started to a certain extent, even by the developments out in the boulevards. They have a certain degree of separation out there. So it's hardly new.
Let's make clear to our listeners what's going on there. Right now, the system carries two types of water, right? Or
most of what we refer to commonly as the grid, which is the older, the existing. Most of the grid is combined, which means that the same water that comes from a flush toilet, sanitary, it will mix with the storm water coming from a catch basin. And then they both go to
the treatment plant
until they exceed the capacity of the treatement plant, and then they overflow directly into wherever the outfall is.
And most of that happens, obviously, in the western part of the city because it's a lower. Is that true?
No, most of it happens in the northwestern part of the city, if you will, but it's not because of elevation. The river's at the same elevation in the North Bay as it is in the South Bay. It has to do with just the when they designed the system, they wanted to bring everything for some reason towards the North Bay, so they cheated. So even Upper Union Street kicks over above 4th Street to underneath the parking lot to Columbia and makes its way over there. You know, I live on Prospect
Avenue. Oh, is that why that special, that one area near the courthouse had such flooding during the big storm?
That was a failure of a 20-inch clay tile main. It had nothing to do with anything. It was just a failure.
Yeah.
But what happens is, like, where I live on Prospect Avenue, Rossman, where you live on Worth Avenue, that starts out at Warren Street and Prison, you know, Prison Alley, and they come together and they start moving more and more over towards Columbia and make their way to the treatment plant. That's why we see the average daily flow. We see 90% of it coming directly to the treatment plant and only about 10% coming from a pump station down from the Amtrak lot carrying, you know, areas of the north side of Warren below 4th and portions of Union and portions of Allen.
So that little pump station down at the Amtrak lot, I mean, that is a pump station for those who wonder what that little building is. Now, the proposal, you're trying to get another pump station, is that it?
Pump station upgraded, a different one.
A different one.
Right. This pump station that we're discussing, it may be a little from the outside, but it is an absolute behemoth of a monster inside. It is designed to handle 5 million gallons a day of flow, and it doesn't even come close to that. We're seeing at most, you know, maybe a million during a torrential downpour. So and that was upgraded at the same time that we upgraded the wastewater treatment plant in 2012. That was part of that project.
Now, the proposals for the upgrade involves separating the lines where? I mean,
We have an existing pump station that's on Power Avenue. That's over by where Hav is, Dinosaur, things like that. Okay. And a large contributor to the, under previous flows up until a couple of years ago, was combined stormwater runoff from the prison, the correctional facility. A couple of years ago, the prison, either DOCS or OGS, did their own separation plan, built a detention pond. So now we don't have those wide flows that are there. The other factor is that the pump station is just old. It was built, you know, in the early 80s. It just needs to be updated. So the plan is twofold. One, to do the necessary upgrades to pumps, you know, make it more energy efficient, tie it in with telemetry, which is a radio communication system that allow the pump station to talk to the plant. But because we don't have those drastic storm flows, we're confident that we can size it accordingly so that we can actually abandon the outfall. Because if it gets too much flow at that pump station, it actually overflows to a catch basin, which has a sign on Power Avenue. And we're very optimistic that we can actually abandon that section, which would prohibit any overflows at all going into that outfall.
Now, that outfall, though, would go directly into the river.
That outfall is tied into the South Bay.
So the South Bay.
So there would be we would actually set being censored already. Yeah.
I have a feeling I know who it is.
I think I do too. So what would happen is we would actually sever that from the South Bay, and you know, you wouldn't have that that outfall. There wouldn't be any potential for regular sanitary under. There's no backup power, so if it loses power, it can overflow. If there's any number of other issues that happen mechanically, it can overflow.
You know, I've had a hard time understanding it. I saw your presentation to the Common Council, and I've heard the critics of this system, and I still don't quite understand. Does it mean there'll be untreated water going into the South Bay?
No, it doesn't mean that at all.
Okay.
What would happen? There would be no connection between the sanitary system and the South Bay at that point. So it's better. It's an improvement.
Yeah. And as you described it to on the air a couple of years ago, of course, there's 30 miles of tunnel, and that the piping system sort of, it picks up all kinds of things. Everything from really large bits of garbage to, you know, household sewage, and it's all about getting it sorted out and to, by the time it gets to the plant, to keep it as to get the water.
I can hear the people turning their dials, changing and yawning, yeah. Going for that cup of coffee.
Yeah,
but I'm okay. I mean, yeah. I have no problem. You know, I enjoy it.
No,
you're absolutely right. There are things, and I do want to, you know, clarify that there is a misconception that stormwater is clean water. Stormwater is not clean water.
Right.
The first step in actually treatment of our sanitary system is street cleaning. You know, we send the storm system is to send the street sweeper out, which we've received a new one earlier last month that was put in the 2014 budget. So we issued a purchase order in January, and it takes 6 months to build.
I have a couple questions. Oh, I don't mean to interrupt you, but
that's okay.
You talked about in your report that the sweeper is conventional and that its jets and brush swings are favorably different. What does that actually mean? How's it better? It's really
well.
The question.
I mean, conventional is a term. If you saw a tractor trailer going down the street, and if the cab over would be if the driver was sitting over top of the wheel,
mm-hmm.
that's a cab over. If the nose is out, the wheels are out in front of them, that's a conventional, like a car or a truck.
Okay.
So. That doesn't really have anything to do. It's just different for them to,
right.
as far as lining up and making their corners. There used to be it was hard piped, the jets. Because what happens is there's water sprays down on the road to keep the dust down, to kind of give everything some friction, so that way the bristles can grab it without, you know, you don't want to have the brushes
that
go can't
be
across
dry.
It and throw it up in the air
right.
and just have it fall back down behind them like Pigpen.
Right.
You know, so it gets... water gets put on it so it can be managed and get directed into
sure.
the machine. You know, it used to be hard piped, and we actually had issues where they would snap or break or catch on something. These are, you know, it's a rather simple modification. They're flexible hoses with the copper fitting on the end, so if they bang into something, they give.
That's kind of a problem with a lot of the machinery in town, it seems like. Even during our winter snowstorm, we had a lot of malfunctions due to little breakages. I mean, it's hard to judge the roadbed when you're in either a snow removal situation or a street cleaning situation, because our roads are kind of hard to manipulate.
Well, yeah. The roads themselves are obviously old. I mean, we've got 30.7 miles of centerline miles of road throughout the city. We do get money from CHIPS, Community Highway Improvement Program, which is through New York State DOT. And it usually averages about anywhere from $150,000 to $200,000 a year. But based on our cost for our treatments of the road, you know, that gets us maybe a mile. So, you know, using CHIPS money exclusively to replace and update roads basically is every 30 years. You really should be updating and replacing the roads in half that time.
Yeah.
So, but there's not the resources to do that.
Right. Getting back to the sweeper, I know a lot of people wonder about the schedule of sweeping. Now, I'm not even aware of it, frankly. I mean, I just understand that there's a certain time that it does affect the parking regulations. And could you explain how it's scheduled and how that's...
Sure. back in the way back time, there actually was a full-time street sweeper who came in at midnight and worked from midnight till 8 in the morning. And that's all that that individual did.
And he covered the entire...
And he covered the whole city. Yeah. And there, you know, much of the city is odd even based on the days. And other parts of the city are, you know, once a week on a selected days, you know, Wednesday, Thursday, regardless, you know, depending on where you are. When that individual went to retire, there was a negotiation. They abolished the position, but they created an overtime component so that way regular street guys would get some, you know, 3 hours a week of overtime by coming in at 4 o'clock in the morning and doing the street sweeping. You know, it was better for the taxpayer because you took a full-time position away, you know, with the benefits and everything else. It was better for the guys on the crew because they got a little taste of overtime. They upgraded the equipment so that way it was more effective and it didn't need 8 hours. It could operate in 3 to 4 hours. And that's why we have the alternate sides, so that way you can theoretically run unabated down along the curb and pick up all the little, you know, nooks and crannies of...
So, but it, I guess people wonder why they need that that length of time when it actually is a job that takes half that time.
Well, I mean, how it's enforced isn't really me.
Right.
I mean, if they wanted to make it... If people wanted to... leave their car until 4 o'clock in the morning and move it to get out of bed and move it just before the sweeper comes,
right.
Then, you know, okay,
yeah,
yippee
right.
for you. I'd right. rather sleep straight through the night. So I think that's why, you know, the idea is that you move it over. And I don't believe enforcement takes place until about 2 o'clock in the morning.
I've on this show and other shows talked a lot about snow removal this year. I go back to something you said in the earlier interview you gave on GXC, and that is, you know, we are a community, and the idea that, you know, it's painless. Winter is painless for residents is absurd. I mean, winter is a difficult time. I'm not trying to suck up to you, trust me, but I do sympathize.
I know your left hook is coming. I can see it.
I do sympathize with what the DPW has to go through during the winter, but... You know, there were a lot of complaints, and I don't know how you want to address them, or if you feel the need to address them. I know there was a procedure. Warren Street comes first,
which wasn't the case before me.
Really,
it was only one side. Warren Street was treated like every other street, and it only had one side done on the first night and one side done on the second night. So I was the one who put that into place. So that way we could get the commercial district done first. And in one of the major storm that we had where we had the 2 feet of snow, there's one run that starts at Front Street, goes all the way up Warren, does one side of Worth, does both sides of 8th, both sides of Park, down Warren, both sides of City Hall, and then finishes up at Front Street. That, we can almost set my clock by it. When we do snow removal, that usually takes about 3 hours. During that one massive storm, that one stretch took 9 hours. So we do get some, you know, our job is to deal with what nature gives us. We don't, you know,
right.
we're not in the precipitation business.
And I think the majority of complaints really were probably more about, like you the same thing the street sweeping, it's more about the enforcement of people who aren't following what they're recommended to do during, you know, getting their cars off the road. It's a pain, but, you know.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, we do have some experience with this. I mean, it's hardly a new process, snow removal. And, you know, some of the complaints are, you know, people inappropriately compare us to Catskill. Catskill's, you know, their business district is significantly smaller, and they also prohibit parking on both sides of the street.
Mm-hmm.
And I tell people, I said, listen, we can get this done a lot faster if we banish cars from city streets. And of course, you know, rightly so, people are like, you know, screaming and because it's not practical. It's not a practical solution, but it's impossible for us to remove snow or even plow it with cars in the way. That's just the simple reality. And I think the other issue is that they try and compare us to towns and state roads, which, you know, they don't have parked cars on state roads, and there's no sewer main valve or manholes and water valve caps that catch on stuff. And, you know, they don't have to worry about any of the obstructions that we have. It's there's no real comparison.
Yeah.
And their trucks are significantly larger and going at faster speeds.
And I noticed reading through your monthly reports, at least this year's, mm-hmm. that so much of it, especially during the harsh winter months, was about just wear and tear, you know, things that break, machines that break, often because of, as you say, different difficulties in the road or just the age of the machine. How do you budget for that kind of thing? I mean, how does that work budgetarily?
Well, we're actually
budget wise.
Yeah, actually, we received the mayor's budgetary guidelines yesterday when I was in the office. So this is the budget season we're entering into. Me personally, I love it. I mean, I'm a numbers guy. I don't have a stitch of artistic quality, but I love painting. With the budget is my tableau. That's my what I want to do for the next year or the next 3 years, the next five. And that's where we start making those commitments in advance. I have been extremely fortunate with the mayor, the treasurer, the council president, and the council. Over the last couple of years, we've taken a series of opportunities to transfer money so that we can make capital equipment purchases. They were originally put in the budget requests and were taken out for obvious reasons. I'm a property owner. I'm a taxpayer. I get it. I used to be council president. I was on the other side of the desk trying to manage, you know, a tax base and needs and benefits, mm-hmm. and I get that too. So I do what I can to present what I think we should be aspiring for as a department, what I know my crew is capable of doing, and at that point, I put it into numbers, and those numbers get presented. And, you know, I routinely go into the first meeting with like a 30-35% increase, and I leave the first meeting with a 7% increase, mm-hmm. because a lot of it just get, which is fine. I mean, it's my job to present options, present solutions, and then it's somebody else's decision to decide whether or not they want to pay for it or not.
Do you think that budgetary restraints are what lead to kind of the patchwork nature of, you know, what you have to do, as opposed to kind of a long-term solution to certain problems?
Absolutely. That's fine. I mean, mm-hmm. You know, I'm a big boy. You know, we're going to live within the conditions that we can. I mean, at no point would I expect there to be a 35% increase in my department's budget. I mean, clearly. But what I do is I present a cafeteria of options, and those that do make the decisions can pick and choose which ones they choose to go for.
I should make it clear to our listeners that of the four areas sort of you're responsible for, three of them pay for themselves, correct?
Two of them do. The other one theoretically does, but not really.
Oh, okay. So we're talking the water treatment plant and the cemetery.
No. Two out of three was good.
Oh.
The sewer system is 100% funded from sewer rates and septage receiving revenue. The water system is 100% funded from sewer rates. And there's a lease agreement with Colarusso that's $200,000 a year. The cemetery is probably...
That's to take away the...
That's for their lease of our quarry that the city purchased in 1969,
oh, okay.
The old Lone Star cement.
Oh.
So the cemetery doesn't have it so good. The cemetery...
Okay, let's get to the cemetery.
The cemetery is just a bad business model. That's just the way it is.
Has anybody ever looked into turning it into, as other cemeteries have, into sort of a nonprofit, independently run entity?
I've heard that those discussions took place a number of years ago, maybe a decade or so. I remember them coming up in budget meetings when Rick Sclera was mayor, and Rick said, you know, they were, they were marching in the streets. They didn't want, you know, this. They didn't want the cemetery to not be controlled by the city because their parents, grandparents, mm-hmm. whatever else were there. I think that between the historical nature of some of the internments, mm-hmm. and the personal nature of many of the internments, that it wouldn't be well received. I'm certainly not opposed to the discussion or the.
Well, it seems, I mean, I understand that the sympathies of the people who have family there, but it seems like a private nonprofit would have a better chance of raising money maintain. I mean, it's a beautiful cemetery, and it's got a lot of historical interest, as you point out.
It's a great cemetery. It's
it does bring in some revenue, right? For
oh yeah, it brings in probably, you know,
what percentage of
we its budget? we budget about $175,000 for anticipated revenue. You know, the important thing from a revenue side is that there's two main factors. One, 9 out of 10 internments already own the plots. An internment is an opening of a grave, for those listeners who don't know.
Right.
So, you know, a plot may sell for, depending on what size and where and how many, anywhere from $500 to $1,000, say. The internment usually is about $1,000. You know, 9 out of 10, you know, if everybody was buying plots that was being interred, we'd be doing, obviously, significantly better, you know, almost, you know, probably 50-70% better in revenue, but that's not the case. So you've got...
Who makes up for the downfall?
There's transfer from the general fund, to cover it. So you have that. It's not revenue neutral. It's revenue negative. It costs more to operate than it does the revenue. There are 25,000 internments in that cemetery from the very beginning in 1780-something, I think. And, you know, for decades and probably a century or so, the perpetual care was an option, and now it's mandated. But even the perpetual care model was based when interest rates were relatively high and cost of employment was relatively low. And that's not the case anymore with, you know, pension increases and health care benefits and such and so forth. So what happens is, you know, we actually, this year, I think our revenue from the interest revenue from our perpetual care fund, I think it's $5,000 out of a couple $100,000 budget. So, and in reality, we have other people that are operating, that are working in the cemetery daily that are paid for from the general fund. They're in parks or they're somewhere else.
Well, that brings up a question. I noticed in the last report that there are two full-time employees and they were both injured or ill or whatever, and you had to transfer people from the general DPW.
Correct.
Now, are we talking about full-time employees who usually mostly ground maintenance?
Well, their primary role is to deal with the internments, you know, the
so
opening of graves.
Oh,
and that.
Okay.
But
so
when
they're diggers. And
yeah, diggers. Okay.
Okay.
And but when that's obviously when that's not taking place, then they're out mowing. Mm-hmm. And
What I wonder is why take two of your men from the regular DPW instead of just hiring temporary summer people?
We do hire temporary summer people. Yes. So, and we have, I think there's one or two up there right now. And they're called seasonal. They're full-time, 40-hour employees, but they're seasonal. They start usually in May sometime and finish up around October.
College students or?
Any number of cross-section.
Yeah.
You know.
Do they have to be civil service?
No. They're part-timers.
But
so.
Your main crew at the DPW is civil service.
They are non-competitive civil service.
Meaning?
Which means they don't have to take a test to have their civil service protection. They have to be in their position for 5 years. And once they have it, it's similar to tenure, if you will. There are competitive civil service positions in my department. I am civil service competitive. I had to present my qualifications to the Civil Service Commission. They had to accept and approve.
Of the state of New York?
Of the Columbia County.
Columbia County.
And they had to review, accept, and allow me to sit for the test. And then I had to take the test and be reachable, which obviously I did. The operators at the treatment plants, both water and wastewater, those are competitive tests. They have to be professionally licensed.
Like less.
They have to be professionally licensed through Waters, licensed through DEC, or Waters licensed through Department of Health, and wastewater through DEC, and then they have to take civil service tests.
So he has to be licensed to just for the general maintenance of that.
He has to be licensed to be qualified to sit for the civil service test.
But it's all related to what he does at the
absolutely.
Waterfront. Yeah,
absolutely.
It's not just
like when I took my civil service test. It was on contracts and management. And sanitary treatment, water
so
treatment.
So it's definitely issue specific to
absolutely.
What you do. It's not just some general.
Yeah, nowhere in the civil service did it ask me about indoor plumbing. You know, I'm not
right.
a plumber. I don't deal with anything inside the property line.
Yeah.
You know.
So getting back to the cemetery, it's one of the, how many actual properties are there that you are responsible for, including the cemetery? Obviously, the pocket parks.
There
all
are
the parks.
I mean, there's a short and a long answer.
Right.
There are 20 buildings, if you will, mm-hmm. that I'm the property manager for. They range from houses. There's one out in Churchtown Reservoir, one at the cemetery. There's the old superintendent's house up by the water plant. Mm-hmm.
Somebody living there?
Yes, people live in all of those.
And are all those, they're rented out at market rate?
They are rented out at whatever rate the Common Council decides they should be charged.
Okay, so it is up to the Common Council.
Yes, I'm not in the leasing renting business. I obviously have the technical expertise for what's involved and what's been negotiated previously, but I don't make the decision and I don't approve or disapprove
of who lives there,
who the leases are, what the amounts are for, and what the terms and conditions are. That said, you know, obviously there's the facilities, the plants, the DPW garage. There's actually property manager for all of the city buildings, city hall, police courts. I have to do a separate budget actually for the New York State Unified Courts because we get reimbursed
from the department, whatever it's called,
from the courts.
Office of Court. What is it, OCA or something like that?
Office of Court, whatever that is. I deal with I always called it the Unified Court System, right. UCS.
Do you have a role in what's happening with the police, the new police building?
I do not. And we have the, there's pump stations, and then there's the grounds. Then there's the parks, which we're overlooking. 7th Street Park, the pocket parks. Those, we're responsible for the maintenance of those. And
by the way, folks, there's a meeting tonight, I believe.
Right? Down at the chamber, yes.
At the chamber at 6:30 or 7?
Somewhere
you can find it online to discuss proposals for the new park. Will you participate in that conversation?
I don't participate in the basic. At this point, it's all about, trying to find a cohesive plan. In this year's budget, I did present, in the 2014 budget, I did present, I believe, a $35,000 line item to, put money aside for putting new pavers in the 7th Street Park and putting new curbing in because, it's just a patch of a patch of a patch and it's not pretty by any stretch of the imagination. The park definitely needs a major facelift.
I did notice one disturbing comment from you back in your last interview. You said, and I quote, "You are not a fan of Christmas decorations."
I don't like that. I mean, I'm Catholic. I mean, I celebrate Christmas. I'm certainly not one of those guys. But
I brought that up because, of course, we had Santa's little whatever it's called.
Yeah. I mean, and I usually qualify that by saying that, in my house, my wife and daughter love Christmas. I mean, they love the smells, the sounds. I do love Christmas music. I will admit to that. And they have to kicking and screaming. I have to go up into the attic and bring down all these boxes of ornaments, and then. Thank God my daughter's old enough where she decorates the tree and does a lot of decorating herself because I always and then taking everything down and bringing it back upstairs. And so it was ironic that I don't even like decorating my own house. And here I am in charge of putting decorations in parks and on City Hall.
What's happening with Santa's little workshop?
That's an
issue that everybody's been asking me to ask you.
Yeah, I mean, it is what it is. I mean, they went, the city purchased the little animatronic guys and ladies and elves and elvinas, whatever the feminine is for that. And, decades ago. And they're, we patched them together as they will from one year to the next.
Is it proposed to be moved from the park?
I've heard no such proposal for it. We have had discussions with Ellen Thurston in her role as the Opera House.
And that's my best friend.
I love Ellen.
So you listen to our show on Thursday afternoons?
I don't listen to Ellen's show, no, but I'm a big fan of Ellen. I always have been.
Let her know.
Well,
she might be listening for all we know.
Well, she's busy. I mean, she's out doing a lot of stuff. God bless her. She's been for probably the last 4 or 5 years been bringing various people down to the garage and I've made the same commitment year after year that, I can provide a workspace for someone who wants to come down and do upgrades and repairs to the shed. We do it anyway. We've put some new roofs on some. We've replaced windows on some. But if somebody wants to come and redo them, we're definitely open to that and we can supply.
Is it correct that the original fountain is in storage?
The
in your garage or wherever, not your personal garage, the DPW's garage.
there's an old garage that used to house the bulldozer when the city actually owned and operated the dump down on the end of North Second Street, which is now the landfill.
Yes, okay.
And it, so she's tucked away in there, and she's badly bruised. As far as the base, which I guess from reading similar sources to what everybody else reading online and otherwise, I believe that the base was supposed to be cast iron and may or may not have been scrapped or whatever. I know it's not on any city property that I've seen.
How did all those fences around the fountain come into place? I mean, is that just was that before your time? Or?
Oh, it's way before my time. Yeah. If you look at the plaque, I think it was from the 70s or something like that for one of the fences. Here's the thing. That fountain, and first of all, in this year, in the 2014 budget, I put in a line item budget to do pavers and upgrade the walkways. The year before that, I put in a line item budget for, I believe, $40,000 to put an honest-to-goodness, actual, real, non-death machine fountain in there. Make no mistake about it, that fountain is a death machine. It is. There is the electrical components in it are not up to code. I mean, we do lockout tagouts when they go into it. But there are lights that are under the water, and I want you to guess what the insulative barrier is between the electrified lights and the water that surrounds it. Could you hazard a guess?
I'm afraid it can't be more. Is it just a piece of plastic?
It is paraffin. It is my guys actually have to melt wax. So, you know, that's not safe. That's why they drain it when they go into it. We do the lockout tagouts. There's a 220 motor in there. It should be in its own housing. That should be double sealed. You know, there are swimming pool quality standards out there for fountains.
Right.
We need a real fountain. And you get a real fountain in there, and we can address whatever the swimming pool open water regulations are, and those fences can absolutely come down.
Well, that's good to know. The part that you need when you do your budget, do you do it all those areas that you control together, or do you break it down, or is it broken down into each section?
If it was up to me, I'd present it as one big mass, you know, little bob and weave, and you know, but you know, no, it's I present them. Each of the departments have their own funds, if you will. So the water department has a fund. We have to make the revenues match the expenses. I present that as its own inclusive budget. Similar with the sewer department. Similarly with the cemetery, although you know that's not a 1-to-1 ratio.
I see that the sewer treatment plant is making money, right? Or is that just enough to cover what it costs to run?
Oh, no. We have a $1.3 million budget down there. So that includes $165,000 worth of debt service from the new the upgrades, which, you know, it's a $12.5 million project. We did get $4.9 million of ERA stimulus money. We got $1.62 million of Green Project Reserve money, which is also stimulus. ERA was the American Recovery, that thing. We had a $200,000 water quality improvement grant, and we had a CDBG Community Development Block grant for $600,000. So we started out with $12.5 million. We paid some short-term financing during construction. We backed out all that other money, and our total debt service on that facility is $4.9 million, structured over 30 years at 0% interest. So the annual debt service is $165,000 a year for a $12.5 million construction project. And our septage revenue is forecasted at $175,000, but we're forecasting realistically about we should exceed $200,000. So that means that 100% of the capital cost of that sewer treatment project is being paid for by other than the local city of Hudson water user.
I should make it clear to listeners that what Rob's talking about is we take in other sewage to treat.
Correct.
For other locations, and that's we do that at a price.
Yes, I mean, sir. Absolutely. Absolutely. So, yeah, they're private haulers that go to you know, septic tanks out in the county or wherever, and they've sucked those out and they come and discharge them.
And that puts no special burden on the plant, right? I mean,
no, we do have operating requirements. There's conditions from DEC
to be able to
do this, which we're fine. Right. You know, we're more than happy to comply, and we do comply with all of those conditions. And you know, it's pretty straightforward. But back to the budget. So the sewer is its own budget. The water is its own budget. The cemetery is its own budget. Then the DPW is one lump sum, which includes buildings, which includes parks, which includes street maintenance, which includes refuse, you know, waste collection, garbage, if you will.
Big question there.
Sure.
Weekends on Warren Street.
Yes.
It seems to many, myself included, I have to admit, that the garbage pickup is very... there's got to be something a little more regular on weekends, because are there people on duty picking up garbage on the weekends?
No, there are not.
Yeah.
No, there's nobody on duty on weekends at all, because the, you know, obviously from a financial issue, the contract stipulates what the hours of the work week are, and they're Monday through Friday from 6:30 to 3 in the summer and so forth. So anybody coming in on a weekend, whether scheduled or not, is going to be getting overtime, whether or not they were on vacation or otherwise. Mm-hmm. We did do this last July 4th weekend, and as a practice going forward, we have scheduled overtime for the garbage crew to come in on whichever the middle day is of a three-day weekend to do a supplemental pickup.
Right, the three-day weekends were really the worst.
Correct. So we do pick up. So say Monday is Memorial Day. Mm-hmm. So what normally would happen is we would do a regular Friday pickup of all the garbage on Warren Street, the parks. It's not just Warren Street. It's all municipal garbage cans throughout the city, including the parks, including the cemetery. Mm-hmm. So that gets picked up Friday afternoon. And then we would come in and pick them up the very first thing that gets done on Monday morning under normal weekends. Under holiday weekends, obviously, it would get pushed back to Tuesday morning. So... You know, I mean, good for us. We've got a bustling economy, and good for us. There's lots of people walking up and down Warren Street. So this 4th of July, we actually did the regular Friday pickup. Friday was the 4th. So we did the Friday pickup on Thursday, and then we scheduled the crew to come in Saturday morning and do all of the parks, the cemetery, and Warren Street again as an intermediate pickup. And, you know, if it looks like we're going to have good weather and lots of traffic and things going on, then we will anticipate doing that on the holiday weekends. As far as a regular weekend thing, I have to tell you, 9 times out of 10, and the pictures aren't, you know, attached to my meeting minutes, but there are a good share of people that are being lazy. They're just setting coffee cups on top of it or putting a pizza box over top of the hole. Mm-hmm. And the reason we have those holes there is because...
to prevent that kind of garbage going in there. Right?
Well, we don't mind if people are going to... you know, roll up a pizza box or something like that.
But I mean,
but they're the household garbage.
Household garbage. Right.
If we, and there was a time when there wasn't those small orifices, if you will, or openings, that people just came down in their slippers and their house coat and bloop, you know, whatever the garbage was went. And you know, we're not providing that service anymore. Businesses have to pay for their own garbage. Residents, I buy garbage bags for my house. Everybody's responsible to take, you know, make some kind of accommodation for their garbage. The cans are there to benefit patrons that are walking up and down the street so they don't litter.
I understand. I just noticed that frequently there's overflow. I mean, the cans are full, and, you know, it's the piles up on top, and it gets pretty unsightly as well as smelly and gross.
Well, garbage is smelly and gross.
Yeah, but it's not as bad when it's in that down that little hole.
We have what we've been doing as I think to abate that is our garbage crews, we talk to them. They've been telling us feedback of, because although you are seeing some garbage cans, it's not pandemic. It is, you know, it's isolated. So our solution is to add more garbage cans, and then hopefully that will mitigate, you know, the overcrowding. And we've done that. We've added a new can in the north side of the 500 block of Warren Street, a new can on the south side of the 400 block of Warren Street. We've got a couple more going in.
Well, that's good news.
Yeah.
Speaking of things you've installed recently, the eastern side of the city, our side of the city, has gotten street lamps now.
Yes.
One thing I've noticed a little strange about them is a couple of them seem not to be really attached to the, they're higher than the side, the the base sidewalk. There's kind of an empty space there.
Oh, well, the bases themselves, the poles are actually bolted directly into the concrete, mm-hmm. and those bases actually pick up and go down.
Uh-huh. So it could be just lifted by...
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, okay.
They actually slide up, so that way, and this was an approved design plan that we did with National Grid, so that way they come, they put a board or a traffic cone underneath it, and they have essentially 360-degree access to the wires that are underneath it. So it's probably something either banged into it or fell against it. Just needs to be kicked back over.
Interesting. So in your DPW budget, you have roughly 25 employees?
Sure.
All full-time?
I have probably 25 full-time, 25 to 30, yes.
And are most of them Hudsonians?
Well, I'm sure they were Hudsonians at one point in their life.
Yeah, they're getting priced out.
Okay. You know, many of them are Hudsonians, yes, mm-hmm. But there are some that are not. Clearly, when we're talking about water and wastewater treatment plants, where we need someone who has a very specific license, you know, we're going to have to expand our search area to get those qualified employees. And there are, and like I said, most, even many of the non-Hudson residents that work for me probably lived in Hudson for the first 10 or 15 years mm-hmm. and moved out.
Right. And they're all civil service and...
They're non-competitive civil service, so they don't have to be civil service.
But they are union.
They're union, yes. And they have to, you know, we do have some minimum standards for, you know, we require commercial driver's licenses simply because we need... There was a time when they didn't all have it, and it just... It negatively impacts our ability to manage our projects because we need to be able to pull and say, well, you know, go get in a truck and go get a load of stone. You know, if we've got someone in the hole and that person is the only one who has a CDL, then they got to come out of the hole and go drive a truck.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, something else doesn't, you know, so we need to have that versatility so that we can, manage our projects more.
So there's not a lot of attrition, I take it. It's pretty much a stable staff for...
Oh no, there's not much attrition at all. They usually leave either retirement or, you know, unfortunately, a lot of my guys don't have the best health.
No, they're great. I mean, the ones I know are great guys, and I wouldn't say that so much for the county. a couple of things I witnessed recently where six guys standing around doing nothing. But you know, that's always easy to spot and not.
Right.
There's always explanations that might not be.
Right. There are people that, you know, if you're waiting for someone to come back with a load of blacktop and they're doing blacktop, then the other three guys aren't really doing a whole lot until the truck gets back. And usually it's a quick run, you know, 10 minutes out and back. But if it's, you know, in the heat of the construction season and, you know, Route 23 is being paved and some other capital projects are being done, there's quite a lineup there.
So I would guess the hardest part of the job is it's really kind of a reaction job rather than you said you're trying to be more proactive, but so much of your time is taken up by reacting to everyday crises that occur in our streets and below our streets.
Yeah, yes. and by the way, that's exactly what management is.
So. Well, I've been talking with Rob Perry, the superintendent of the Hudson DPW. Or Hudson, what's your actual superintendent?
Superintendent of Public Works.
Public Works, right, because DPW is a part of the Public Works. And I want to thank you for coming in and answering all these questions. I'm sure there are more that people have, but you've been very helpful.
Well, great.
So thanks a lot.
Well, thanks for inviting me. I was glad to be here.
I'll be right back with a couple closing thoughts. Okay, that was another edition of We the People. And I just want to close with a couple comments. Gossips of Rivertown reports today that there's been some positive developments in the a story we've covered here also about the transportation of and storage of bulk oil and other hazardous materials. And so check out Gossips of Rivertown, the story Oil on the Hudson, because it tells you how you can get involved, make your opinions known to the State Department of Environmental Conservation. Lastly, I'd like to mention there has been a kind of odd development in the airport story, which I encourage you to investigate further. You know, the story we covered here extensively about, getting the runway situation straightened out. It turns out that Art Basson, who was the chairman of that committee, has handed over the commission to Mike Benson. What's that about? Benson was an ardent foe of most of what the committee did in the past, rarely showed up to meetings. It's a curiosity, to say the least. Anyway, my name is Tom DiPietro, and this has been another edition of We the People. Oh, and there's the train coming by. Thanks for listening.
WGXC 90.7 FM, Acre. The tumbleweed of the airwaves.
Come listen to the all-new Sugar Shack Jukebox, featuring R&B, funk, soul, classic rock, psychedelic,